Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. As part of our treasure hunt for solutions, today we're talking about solutions to global climate change. This week, the nations of the world came together in Paris and reached an historic agreement to reduce the carbon emissions that aggravate global warming. Every country agreed to take action. Some people are calling the Paris Agreement the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel era. Fossil fuels include oil, coal, and natural gas, which when burned emit carbons. Is this the end of the fossil fuel era? Does the shift to renewable energy have enough momentum now to be unstoppable? Will humanity stop carbon emissions fast enough to prevent the worst ravages of climate change? Here to talk with us about all this and more is Michael T. Clare, director of the Five College Program of Peace and World Security Studies based at Hampshire College, and the defense correspondent of The Nation magazine. He is the author of 14 books on international energy and security, including The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Michael Clare, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. Pleasure to be with you.
Yes. I read your article in The Nation that was posted 2 days ago, and I thought you wrote one of the most important articles I've ever seen about global climate change. So I want to thank you for writing it and encourage our listeners to read it. Now, in that article, you make reference to the Paris Agreement, and you put it within the context of important long-term trends. Do you think the Paris Agreement marks the beginning of the end for the fossil fuel era?
I do. That plus other things that are going on simultaneously. Not by itself. The agreement by itself is not going to bring an end to the fossil fuel era, but other things that are happening in conjunction simultaneously will. And what I mean is the global shift that's taking place, the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And there's a lot of momentum behind that that's occurring right now. And it's really, it's that shift that's going to make the difference more than anything else.
Yeah, and I think it's just so encouraging to see action on many fronts. So we know the Paris Agreement is by the governments of what the governments are going to do, and it's great that everybody's stepping up, at least some. But the other thing was that the Paris conference was an occasion for Bill Gates to make a big announcement and about his getting together with other billionaires to form the Breakthrough Energy Coalition. Can you tell our listeners, what is Bill Gates doing along with his billionaire friends there with the Breakthrough Energy Coalition?
Yeah, okay. Well, this club of billionaires now, I have to say, I wish that we didn't have to depend on billionaires to do things that the rest, you know, that government should be doing. But that said, this group of billionaires, it also includes Jeff Bezos. My mind went blank.
Jeff Bezos of Amazon.
That's right, Jeff Bezos.
And Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook.
That's right. Thank you. And others from India and elsewhere in the world. What they'd want to do is to pour billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars, into cutting-edge technologies that will speed the transition away from fossil fuels to renewable forms of energy of all kinds. And they particularly want to put their money into ideas and projects that are at the laboratory stage. What they say is, and I could confirm from my travels around the world to universities, that there are a lot of ingenious ideas being developed at university laboratories around the world that could be very promising, but they often languish in the university setting because they don't have the money to scale up to full-scale enterprises. So what the Gates Enterprise will do is to provide money to scale up these initiatives to the point where they could be commercially viable.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. I was delighted that you highlighted that in your article because I thought that did not get enough play. I think the fact that Bill Gates and this club of billionaires has agreed to pump a lot of money into developing the green technology is as important, if not more important, than what the countries have agreed to do. So I think it's a really exciting development.
Yeah, now, they also expect to make a lot of money in the process down the road. That
right.
is, they hope that, now, not all of these ideas are going to pan out.
But that's part of it with venture capital. They invest in 10 different things and hope one of them is a home run.
Exactly.
That's
what's going on here. They're going to put money into these, hoping that out of the many ideas now under development, out of that will come the new developments that will provide renewable energy at a fraction of the cost of what's now the case.
Yeah, it's just the right kind of support economically that people need. The scientists need it for doing research and development, and the companies need it to take the good ideas and turn them from a pilot into something that's scaled up and can actually be used. So having that money available is going to dramatically speed up that whole process, which is exactly what we need.
Yes.
Countries would be doing that, but here we have the billionaires stepping up, and some people would argue that's the role of business anyway. The government shouldn't be picking winners and losers in the corporate world.
Yes, that's right. Now, Eleanor, there's been some criticism of the Gates plan in the sense that they're looking into ideas that are still in the laboratory stage instead of putting money into existing technologies that with more money could be even more efficient. Like, they're not putting money into solar panels or wind turbines to make them more efficient, which might be a better use of money. We could have a discussion about this. Instead, the Gates is going to put money, for example, into advanced nuclear reactors and other ideas that are still not fully tested. Now, I think that's a good idea. I think we have to do both.
I think both is right. And, the thing like with the solar panels, it's the right idea, but there may be a whole new imaginative technology that we could use. I was reading the other day about someone's working to develop a prototype where they just put a little patch on a window that you could barely see, and then that patch collects the sun and solar power that's coming through the window and creates solar power for the house. And there's nothing invasive about it. You have to cut out your roof and install the panel. It's just a very simple patch. So I think using some imagination and coming up with some whole new technologies is a good idea. And, I remember you and I have been at this for a long time, and it was back in 1984. I led the National Peace and Environmental Coalition. And we had a platform that we brought to the Democrats and Republicans of what we thought needed to be done. And part of the platform was about investing in renewable energy and a redesign for greater efficiency on the scale of the Manhattan Project that, I think our listeners know, in World War II, the U.S. government set up the Manhattan Project to develop the nuclear bomb and brought in the best scientists and pumped in a bunch of money and whatever they needed, and it was highly successful for what their intention was. But our thought was, let's get something on the scale of the Manhattan Project to be having our best scientists not thinking about how to create more and more devastating bombs, but how do we create more energy efficient technology.
Right. And there are many people who are calling for that. But as you know, given the current political environment in Washington, the intransigence of the Republican Party, That's not going to happen with government funding, hence the importance of this initiative by private finance to find it, to fund an equivalent enterprise.
Right. So, you know, hats off to Bill Gates and the Billionaire Club for doing something socially useful with their money, and I hope they do make money for it. I think they will make money from it. They just have to be patient about it, and it's not going to be maximum profits for the next quarter, but it's an investment in the future of humanity, and I think they will make money from it. So it's very exciting to see that new development.
Yes.
You also... Yes. Go ahead.
Please, you were going to, I was going to switch to some of the other initiatives, and I bet that's what you were going to say next.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about what's happening with India and some of the other areas.
So India and France announced a joint initiative at the Paris conference, a global solar initiative. And this is a drive to assemble lots and lots of money from both public and private sources to speed the implementation, the deployment of solar energy, especially in developing countries in the global south. And this is, you know, complementary to the Gates plan in the sense that it is going to focus on more on existing technology, on solar power, which the leaders, especially Prime Minister Modi of India and President François Hollande of France, say are especially attractive to countries in the global south, which are close to the equator and have access to year-round sunshine. So their plan is to try to make solar panels as cheaply as possible and as easy to deploy in those countries as quickly as possible so that more and more of the energy of the developing world will come from solar power.
And that's another exciting development because you think about it, and really pretty much all the developing countries have access, you know, have a lot of sunshine if they could get the technology and capture that and use that for what they need to develop. And, you know, we know the fossil fuel companies have been using the argument that the developing countries should be relying on cheap oil and in order to propel the development of their countries, which up until now has kind of been a lot of what's been going on. But it seems to me there's a big shift here now in that people in the developing countries are going, well, you know what, the fossil fuel era is, you know, is in the past, and we want to get into the clean, green economy and kind of could just maybe leapfrog over all that infrastructure and production stuff that the developed world has around oil and gas and go right into solar technology to power their development. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's happening in many places around the world, in developing countries. And you're right. The fossil fuel companies have put a big bet on their future hinging on demands coming from the developing world. They know that the demand for fossil fuels is leveling off in the older industrial countries or is even going to go down in the future because of increased efficiency, because we're turning away from coal, because of greater restrictions on the consumption of carbon-based, you know, on greater curbs on emissions of carbon and the like. So there's really no growth future in the older industrialized countries for fossil fuels. The only potential for growth that the fossil fuel companies could see was in developing countries, especially China, India, Brazil, Turkey, Indonesia, Thailand, countries like that that are on a rapid growth path. And so they made a big bet that this is where their future revenues would come from, and they've built a lot of new refineries and production facilities and pipelines in that part of the world. And they go around saying that they're performing a humanitarian mission. Those are the words they use.
Don't you love their self-serving arguments?
Yeah, humanitarian mission by providing cheap energy to the developing world. And up until now, you know, a lot of countries, well, even today, many developing countries are buying into that argument because they do want to provide their citizens with energy quickly. India, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, among others. But increasingly, they're coming to understand that this is a suicidal path because those countries are going to be the worst hit by climate change. They're much more vulnerable than the older industrial countries for the most part, and mainly because they are agricultural countries. They're closer to the equator, which is going to suffer more from climate change and so on. And they're coming to see the advantage of relying instead on renewable energy. So there's a huge shift in the global south away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy, especially solar. And there have been huge strides in that direction in the past year. Another factor that's speeding this transition is that the cost of renewables is dropping very rapidly. Five years ago, solar energy, wind energy was not competitive with fossil fuels absent government subsidies. But that's changing very rapidly. In many parts of the global south, solar power in particular is totally competitive with fossil fuels. And of course, it's much better from an environmental perspective. So now you're seeing countries all over Africa and the Middle East, instead of building new coal plants, they're building new solar panels.
Yeah, it's very exciting to see what's happening in the developing countries. And you talked about how the newly industrialized countries led by China and India are going to spend $2.7 trillion on renewable-based power plants between 2015 and 2040, which is a lot more even than the older industrialized countries are going to spend on renewables. Is that right?
That's right. Now, a lot of that is going to come from China, because China is really the biggest spender on renewables in the world today and accounts for a very large share of that amount. And given the horrors of pollution from coal use in China today, we've been reading about that, the red alert in Beijing this past week. Given that, I think that the shift to renewables will occur even faster in China. So you're going to see a lot of new investment in renewable energy.
Yeah, I'm so encouraged to see that. And that's a fairly recent shift. I had been invited a few years ago to speak at a women's conference in South Korea about nuclear weapons and nuclear power and how to move away from reliance on nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And China was at that conference, and they were very adamant about saying, well, we still want to have, coal plants, and we want to have nuclear power that China was developing so rapidly with all the people. They wanted to really use every available energy source to fuel their economic development. And I think what's happening, you talk about the air in Beijing now is so unbreathable. It's dangerous to breathe, and people going out wearing gas masks. I've talked to people who are there, and they say they're like gagging. There's times you can't even go outdoors because the air pollution is so bad. So I think China is finally waking up to the combination of seeing what the air pollution is from their coal plants and also the money that could be made worldwide in renewable energy.
Yeah. Well, there's another incentive here, Eleanor, and that's that I think the survival of the Communist Party and leadership is at risk. I think, from what I understand from my students from China, that Chinese social media is being merciless in condemning the authorities for allowing this to happen, for conditions to be so bad. And I think that the leadership, Communist Party leadership, understands that they face potential wide-scale revolt by the urban middle classes if they don't do something about the pollution very, very soon. People say that you were saying the conditions in China are so horrible that children can't be let outdoors, that you take your health at risk if you go outdoors in these conditions. Nobody wants to live that way. If the party is held responsible and doesn't do anything about it, I think their days are numbered.
Yeah, nothing like a potential revolt to get the attention of political leaders.
Yeah,
and,
right.
So whatever it takes to get there, they're getting there, and that's so critical because China is such an important player now in this whole area of the need for reducing carbon emissions. They're very big players. You know, U.S. and China are the two biggest in the world that need to kind of rein in those carbon emissions. So it's encouraging to see they're moving rapidly in that direction. It is kind of the upside of the centralized control in government is once they decide to move a certain way, they can do it. And, in this case, it might have some positive benefits. We were talking about how some of the underdeveloped countries are moving to renewable energy and seeing that as the path of the future, and the fossil fuels are kind of the path of the past. And it's interesting to note that even some countries that are major oil-producing countries are focusing on renewable energy. Tell us what's happening about, Dubai in the Mideast and their major clean energy initiative.
Yes, Dubai, which is part of the United Arab Emirates, has announced that they're going to move very rapidly towards reliance on renewables for their own energy. Now, put this in context, Dubai and the other members, Abu Dhabi, of the United Arab Emirates, are major oil exporters, so they want to continue to get the benefits of all the money they make by selling oil, but they want to convert their own energy use more and more to renewable energy so that they could more and more of the oil that they produce can be exported to finance their way of life, their very lavish way of life. So yes, they are moving rapidly in that direction, and Dubai as a city is going to move to be very solar dependent. They've ordered that every building in Dubai be solar powered by 2030 or 2040, that the entire city, every single building will have to have solar panels.
That's amazing. And I actually somehow got on an invitation list a couple of years ago when Dubai had a big event in New York City where they were announcing their plans on renewable energy. And it was at the Jeremiah Hotel right on downtown New York. And they had lots of high-level people there. And they described what they wanted to do, and they actually have an island off the coast there of Dubai in the Gulf, and they wanted to make it a showcase of energy efficiency and renewable energy. And their plan was to develop it all there and showcase it there and then to take it and move it throughout Africa and the Mid East. So they're mm-hmm. thinking in a big way, and they certainly can take the money that they've made from oil and petroleum and kind of invest it in a productive and positive way to help the world really move forward with renewables.
Mm-hmm. There's another interesting dimension to this discussion. that I see speculated on in the media, and that is, to what degree do the rulers of the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the other oil-producing countries of the Middle East, to what degree are they saying to themselves that, as we started earlier, you know, the fossil fuel era is going to come to an end in the not-too-distant future, and the demand for their products is going to evaporate or greatly diminish, not right away, but in time. And that bears on the issue of the plunge in oil prices right now. Oil prices are at their lowest since the height of the economic crisis, the financial crisis of 2008. They were down to $35 last week. That's the lowest they've been in a very long time. A year ago,
$35 for a barrel of oil.
A year ago, it was $115. So, one reason why it's so low, well, there are two reasons. One is the demand has not grown according to their expectations. And the second reason is that the OPEC countries, unlike in the past, have not reined in their production. They're producing flat out, even though there's not as much demand as was expected. So they're pumping. That brings the price of oil down. Now, partly this is intended to undercut shale oil production in the United States and other competitors like Iran and especially Russia. So there's a geopolitical aspect here. But some are speculating that the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the others are doing this because they figure, you know, they might as well sell it at any price now because there may be no market for it at all in another 30, 40 years when the whole world has converted to renewable forms of energy. And I think that's a very interesting question.
I hadn't heard that analysis.
Yeah.
And once you say it in this context, it makes a lot of sense. And we're all grateful here. The low cost of gas when you go to fill up your car now is a great relief, really, for a lot of Americans. I went to a meeting in Pennsylvania 2 days ago, and when I filled up my tank, it was $1.99 a gallon, and I hadn't seen that in so long. So this is amazing. The price of gas is so low. And it actually, if you think about it, you know, we all love the personal saving at the gas pump, but in a bigger scale, it's been a major economic boost to middle and lower income Americans that the cost of gas has like plunged to half of what it was. And that means a ton of extra money that we all have in our pockets that's actually been part of the economic recovery we've experienced since the Great Recession. So we're very grateful for that price drop in oil.
Yeah. Now, this has earth-shattering repercussions, of course. The profits of the major oil companies has plummeted, and the income of the major oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, Russia, Mexico, Nigeria has also plummeted with all kinds of geopolitical implications. One of the reasons that Russia is in some, that Putin is having so much trouble in his efforts to dominate the space around the in the former Soviet Union is because the income of the Russian state has dropped by half because they get so much money from oil. I shouldn't say half. They get half of their income from oil and gas sales, and the value of those exports has dropped in half. So it's been a crippling blow to Russia, but also to Venezuela. And that explains why the party of Hugo Chavez had a terrible setback in elections a week ago. But the same thing is happening in all of these oil-producing countries, that the plunge in oil prices has had crippling effects on these countries and on the big oil companies. So this has major, major consequences. And everybody is asking, why is this so? And there are a number of reasons why it's so, including, as I said, a drop-off in demand from China in particular and other developing countries in Europe where the economy is sputtering, but also because in the United States the efficiency of automobiles has increased so much. This is the initiative of the Obama administration. So even though the prices have gone down in the U.S., and people may be driving more, they're still using less oil than they used to because their cars are more efficient. So the demand, the future demand for oil doesn't look very promising. And nobody is willing to cut back on their production, which means you have lower and lower prices.
Yeah,
hope that
you
was
know,
clear. That was a long-winded discussion, but this is a very important question, not just for American consumers, but for global politics.
Absolutely, and I had heard the speculation that the OPEC countries were increasing their production in order to drive out the natural gas drilling and competitors. And the thought was, well, they'll drop it now, put the natural gas people out of business, and then
not the natural gas, the fracking for oil in the United States, in North Dakota and in Texas in particular.
Yes, the fracking, and I think they're kind of succeeding somewhat at that because I hear that that's somewhat slowing down now compared to where it was a couple of years ago.
Yes,
but. It's the first time I've heard someone suggest that the OPEC countries might be producing flat out now and to sell now and get what they can because there might not be much of a market for oil in 30 or 40 years. That's really amazing. And it's possible.
Now this is speculation. And,
right,
and,
exactly.
Whether that's a motive or not, I can't attest to that. I don't know what goes on in the hidden rooms of the royal palace in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, but people are speculating that, and I think that there's reason for that to think along those lines. I think the Saudis do understand that as a result of the climate agreement in Paris that we began speaking about, and the other trends we've been talking about, that over time the demand for oil is going to decline and decline more and more as we go further into the future. So they may very well say to themselves, let's sell it while we can.
Yeah, very possible. And clearly the Mideast countries know there's a limit to the oil business, whether it's from the fact that the renewable energies are picking up a lot of steam worldwide and people are turning more to that, or, you know, just the fact that oil at some point is going to run out anyway, so it's not going to be there forever. But whatever is motivating them, it is interesting to see Dubai there in the United Arab Emirates really doing their whole clean energy strategy and trying to make the United Arab Emirates a global center of green energy. So even them, like where so much of the oil of the world, you know, big concentrations down there, they're planning to have 75% of their energy coming from clean energy sources by 2050. So, you know, so they themselves are partaking in this whole major shift into renewables.
Yeah, I think they understand that, among other things, I think they understand that the wealth that they now enjoy cannot last forever if they rely entirely on oil sales. You know, they're a monocrop, to use an agricultural term. They're a monocrop economy. And I think they're coming to understand that that this will not last forever. And if they want their children and grandchildren to enjoy the same lavish lifestyle they enjoy now in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Riyadh, they're going to have to plan a transition to a post-petroleum economy. And so they're starting to invest in that now. In Abu Dhabi, for example, there's a company called Masdar that's building an entire city that's totally sustainable, based exclusively on renewable energy. This is in a desert in the middle of a petroleum-producing country. They're creating the world's first city built from scratch to run on renewable energy. And they see this as a platform, as a testbed to develop technologies that they will export, that this will become their next, after oil goes, that this will be their export, will be green technology.
Well, they're certainly reading the tea leaves right on that one. You talk about the International Energy Agency telling us that between now and 2040, global investments in renewable power capacity are going to total $7 trillion, accounting for 60% of all power plant investment. So that's truly amazing. We're not talking about some distant future. We're talking about between now and the next 25 years, that more than half of all the power plant investment is going to be in renewable power capacity.
That's right. And that's what the IEA says. And that means that you're going to create entire new industries or fuel, yeah, wrong word, drive the creation of world vast companies and enterprises just producing renewable energy. And these companies will, in time, be able to compete economically, politically, and otherwise with the fossil fuel companies, which now we know have enormous political clout. But once this amount of spending is devoted to renewables, those companies, those enterprises, the unions that form around them, the communities that form around them, will be able to rival Houston and Calgary and other oil-producing political enterprises that have had so much influence in the past. And that's going to be a good thing.
Yeah, that's going to be a great thing. And, you know, we know with the rise in use of renewable energies will be a drop in the cost of renewable energy. As we get more of this technology developed, more of it out there, it's like when television first came out, they were very expensive, and then the more they produced them, the more the price came down, and now you can get big flat screens for not so much. So the price of renewables, what's happening with the price of renewable energy? Is it down now and competitive, or do we still have a little ways to go to have the price be competitive with fossil fuels?
Yeah, at this point, renewables are not entirely competitive. Well, certainly not in northern latitudes like where I am in Massachusetts. They are competitive in closer you get to the equator, where there's more sunshine more of the time, solar, or in places like Scotland and Scandinavia, where there's a steady source of wind. But at this point, the key missing piece in the puzzle is storage capacity for energy, for electricity, because as we all know, the sun goes down at night and wind sometimes doesn't blow. So and at those times, you need backup systems, and that's usually provided by existing sources of energy, which could be fossil fuel plants or nuclear plants. You have to have something that can generate electricity 24/7, not just when the sun is out. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. So The key issue here is developing storage ability so that during the daytime when the sun is out that you could store some of the energy that you get from the sun in some kind of battery system of some or some kind of electricity reservoir so that when the sun goes down or when the wind doesn't blow, you can tap into that reservoir and have sunlight energy 24/7 or wind energy 24/7. Now, we're getting very close to that. That's where the real breakthrough technology innovation is taking place, is in storage. And I would predict in the next 5 to 10 years, you're going to see immense advances in storage technology. The company Tesla, the automobile company Tesla, the electric car company, is building a multi-billion-dollar plant in Reno, Nevada, to make advanced batteries. And some of these will be available for this storage purpose, so that if you have a solar array on your house, you can get one of these Tesla batteries someday and store the sunlight during the daytime and then use it at nighttime without having to go to the grid for electricity coming from a coal plant somewhere or a nuclear plant somewhere. So, yes, that was a long-winded answer, but that's where the breakthroughs are going to come, is in electricity storage.
Well, let's hope that Bill Gates and the Breakthrough Energy Coalition put some money into that solar and wind storage issue. That would be awesome.
Yeah, now there's a lot of work going on, and I would predict not just from them, but also from the people like Tesla and other companies are also investing big time in this.
Very good. Well, and, you know, part of the problems renewables have had up to now is that the fossil fuel companies have had huge subsidies for decades and decades. And
that's
more
right.
Recently, there's been some subsidies going into renewable energies, but it's still nowhere near on par. And you talk about worldwide, we've got $112 billion to underwrite renewable energy, but that's only one quarter of the $490 billion in subsidies given globally to the fossil fuel industry. So, even, you know, the fossil fuel industry still is getting the lion's share of subsidies in the energy field.
That's absolutely right. And if you took away the fossil fuel subsidies, then renewable energy would be nearly competitive with fossil fuels.
Yeah, so that's what I would say. If you just, you know, take away the subsidies, you know, and it amazes me. We have these capitalists who talk about the free market and we shouldn't interfere with the free market, and yet here we are, $490 billion in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah.
It's very distressing to me. I actually saw a panel of the oil executives in the United States. They were brought to testify into Congress. And it was they were talking about the subsidies that the American taxpayer is giving to the oil industry. And one of the congressmen asked them, he said, well, you realize, gentlemen, that you have the absolute most profitable companies in the history of humankind. Why do you think you deserve subsidies from the American taxpayer? And they were all like, well, yeah, we do get a lot of money. That's just how it goes.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
Yeah, it's outrageous. You know, so the amazing thing to me is that renewables are making such headway, even in spite of the fact that the fossil fuel industry is getting four times as much in subsidy. And even with that huge advantage in the fossil fuel companies, renewables are still making great headway.
Yep. And we'll see much more of that in the future.
Yeah. So do you have any ideas on how do we stop subsidizing oil? I mean, it just seems to me we had this big ComRU, meetings galore for many years now on what to do about global climate change and how to stop the carbon emissions. It would seem to me the very first thing you would do would be, you know, when you're in a hole, stop digging. One of the very first things we should do is stop having we, the taxpayers, subsidizing the oil industry to kind of prop them up.
Do you think there's any prospect for
stopping those subsidies?
Yeah, I think that has to be a major drive, a political drive in Congress. But the fact is that the biggest subsidies are not in the United States. They're in major oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and the UAE and Venezuela in particular, where Nigeria is another one, where gasoline is sold at sub-cost prices as a way of pacifying the public. So that's really where the worst offenses are occurring. Because these are oil countries, oil states, where the leadership is so dependent on oil production that they pay off their public with cheap gasoline. That's where you have to make a change, and it's a little hard for us here to have much influence on that.
Yeah, well, hopefully the drop in the price of gas is going to help with that. And I know Venezuela and some of the other countries try to keep the price of gas low and subsidize it, you know, so that their citizens can get around and some benefit to their citizenry. But, yeah, we can actually start here. I've seen the problem of subsidizing oil for the U.S. I've seen quotes on that of, you know, upwards of $50 billion a year. You know, it's serious money, and I know most of it, of the $490 billion a year subsidies given globally to fossil fuel industries, comes from other countries, but we could certainly start with our $50 billion or whatever it is now
yes.
in the United States. Just stop the subsidies, let the free market reign. I think renewables are going to win hands down.
Yes, I agree. Now, President Obama has called for that repeatedly in his State of the Union messages, but that's fallen on deaf ears, I'm afraid to say,
yeah.
in Congress.
Well, I think we may need some new members of Congress in there, which I think we're probably going to get next year.
Well,
so
we
with
should
all
hope
of
so.
This, yeah, this happening with the drive to more renewable energy, even the oil-producing companies moving towards renewable energy. Do you think there's so much momentum now that there is no stopping the shift from fossil fuels to renewables?
There's no stopping the shift from fossil fuels to renewables. There is still a question about when the tide will be fully turned. I mean, the direction of change is unquestionable in the direction of renewables, but renewables are still, you know, less than a quarter, even less than that, like 10% of total energy in the world today. And so they have a lot of catching up to do. And the question is how fast that's going to occur. And the speed of change matters to us, because the slower the transition occurs, the more carbon emissions are going to be poured into the atmosphere, the hotter the planet is going to get, and the more climate change disasters are going to occur. On the other hand, the faster the transition occurs, the less carbon dioxide will be poured into the air, and the less damage we could expect from climate change. And what the summit in Paris was intended to do was to make that shift occur faster. And if all of the promises that were made in Paris are carried out, then we will see an acceleration of the shift from fossil fuels to renewables. But it still won't be fast enough to prevent temperatures from rising much more than they have already. and causing a lot more climate change catastrophes in the future. So this round in Paris was a very important first step, and it provides a blueprint for further action, but it's not by itself sufficient to ensure the transition that's necessary to avert full-scale climate change.
Right. Well, you know, at least we're now heading in the right direction, and that's something to be hopeful about. And it's interesting, you're a professor as well as a director of the program there at the Five Colleges up and based in Hampshire College. What are you advising your students when they look to you for career advice of what they should be doing?
You know, that's something that is part of my job that I most appreciate, is to work with young people at the colleges. By the way, the other members of the Five College Consortium are Amherst College, Smith College, Mount Holyoke College, and the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And I teach at all five of those, and I meet students from all five. And more, they like the other students I meet at the other colleges I visit, are increasingly aware of the impact that climate change is going to have on their lives. I'm a old guy now, so I don't think I'll live to see the full-scale consequences of climate change. But my students will, and they're very aware that the world that they're going to grow up in, or lead adult lives in, I should say, is going to be very different from the world of today. It's going to be a much more menacing world, a hotter world, and much more storm-riven world. So they're very aware of this, and more they want to have their lives, their careers, connected to the struggle to slow the pace of climate change. So they ask me about what career options are available to them. What can they do in their life to address this future that they see before them?
And so and still earn a livelihood.
And yeah, exactly. So I tell them about they can go into all kinds of alternative energy options. They could become solar engineers or wind engineers, or many of the frontiers that we've been talking about are going to need huge numbers of people to develop these new technologies we've been discussing. We need new transportation systems that don't rely on petroleum, new vehicles or entire new modes of transportation. We're going to have to rebuild our cities so that they don't rely on automobiles and trucks to move goods and people, but other forms of transportation, and don't rely on fossil fuels for their energy systems. We're going to need buildings that are much more energy efficient. So there's going to be a need for green urban design, green city planning. I talk with them about that. We need environmental lawyers to address all of the issues that are going to come out, as these new requirements coming out of the Paris Agreement and all the other laws that will be passed in the future about increased renewable standards for utilities. All of this is going to require lawyers and regulators and administrators and public officials who are totally cognizant about the climate and energy issues. So there are many ways in which young people can participate as professionals in this necessary transition and earn a livelihood, as you say.
Well, that's great advice for the students and even people considering mid-career shifts. And do you have any advice for our listeners on what they can do to support this revolution in renewable energy?
A lot of the best efforts are being undergone at the state and municipal and county level in the United States? Because as we all know, the federal government is paralyzed. There's gridlock in Congress, so you can't look to Washington for progress. So you have to ask what is being done at the local level. Many, many towns and cities around the United States, wherever I go, there are initiatives to make the city or the town or the county or the state more reliant on renewables, to build more bike lanes, to build affordable public transportation, to get more of the state's energy from renewable sources of energy, to make the towns more resilient to climate change. So I would say to investigate what's being done at the local and state level and how you could get involved in those efforts. And I'm certain that everywhere in the U.S. there are groups like that working to that end. There's also the work of protesting some of the more egregious efforts of the fossil fuel industry to try to increase our addiction to oil and gas, and 350.org is the group that I think is most effective in that respect.
That's great advice. And how can our listeners learn more about your work going forward?
Well, you know, I write for The Nation magazine, so they can go to thenation.com, or I write for a website called tomdispatch.com, and they could all go there to see my work on this. Those are the best places. And you, as you said, my most recent book is called The Race for What's Left, which is about the global drive to exploit the world's last remaining natural resources.
That's wonderful. That's all the time we have. Michael Clare, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your incredibly important work.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you, Eleanor. Best wishes to all our listeners.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.